not interesting, and it's bitten his ass forever.
Honey, get over it. When you light your hair on fire, what you get is a burnt scalp. I'm not saying Alice is Mother Teresa, but then, as I understand, neither was Mother Teresa.
During our Chez Panisse interview, I ask Waters about the letter.
What letter?
She asks, stunning me. The letter from you that he put on the wall at Stars.
You know, I can't even remember the letter. What did I say?
I've never seen it, but it was after a dinner here, and you were singing his praises, and he put it up on the wall at Stars near the VIP area.
Oh, yes. I do remember it.
I tell her that a former waiter from Stars told me that Waters had come in for dinner a few times, and that I couldn't square that with their vituperative separation.
I think the letter was describing a meal that maybe he made for Richard Olney. I think it might have been. And I think he was proud of the meal, and the fact that I really liked him sort of proved that I really liked his cooking. Yeah, it was a personal letter, but I can't remember the details of it. But I do know that it was a personal letter to him. And I probably wouldn't have put something like that on the wall. But it didn't keep me from going.
There are three sides to every story. Jeremiah Tower had long fascinated me, enough so that I sought him out for an interview for my blog before I'd sold this book. Jeremiah had flitted in and out of the public eye since shuttering the Star's mothership in 1999, and his absence, as absences can, had inflated his character. He had skipped the work-for-hire stage to which so many chefs submit themselves. It was well known that he was in Mexico, falling back on his architecture degree, flipping houses. Tower and I met at Michael White's Midtown restaurant, I Fiori, for drinks and to conduct an interview. He was everything the legend had led me to expect. Handsome, dapper, with a pocket square tucked into his checkered sport coat, and commanding. Tower was also in the early stages of a mission. He had recently launched a Twitter account, of which I was one of a handful of followers. He had also launched a website. He was puttering around with Facebook, establishing connections with old friends and colleagues. The interview was a pleasure, because Tower is willing to play ball, answer just about anything. And we hit it off, making dinner plans at the Chinese restaurant Red Farm 2 days later, though I remember being surprised at his availability. We stayed in touch, but it wasn't until the following year that I learned the extent of his PR mission. In November 2013, Gail Peary and John Clark recreated Stars for one evening at their Mission Street restaurant, Foreign Cinema, in San Francisco. It was a happening. San Francisco restaurant critic Michael Bauer was there. In the kitchen were Stars alums, Bruce Hill, Dominique Crenn, Emily Lucchetti, and Loretta Keller. Tower was in a chef's coat, toasted the diners with a flute of champagne. Franz, who says he wasn't consulted before the event was scheduled, was on holiday in Europe. The next day, Tower gathered a group of his old crew and some new friends, including a couple from Cozumel, for lunch upstairs at Zuni Cafe. Lucchetti was there, as were Steve Ranian and his wife Jules, who also cooked at Stars. Everybody was mic'd up, and a small camera crew circled the table on tiptoe, filming the conversation. 0.0, the production company responsible for the television series No Reservations and Mind of a Chef, were considering making a documentary about Tower and gathering exploratory footage. Zuni still holds a place in the hearts of many who once cooked in San Francisco. Word spread to the balcony that Jonathan Waxman was simultaneously dining downstairs. During the lunch, somebody referenced a dispute they'd had. "There are three sides to every story," Tower yelled to Lucchetti. "Your side, the other side, and the truth," Lucchetti yelled back, and everybody burst into laughter.
I've since learned that the line is a favorite of Tower's, a go-to chestnut which, it seems to me, is meant to inoculate him against any claims that his side of any story isn't 100% accurate. Since then, Tower's been making up for lost time, showing up at food festivals, including one devoted to honoring him, the second annual Roots of American Food Conference, a small gathering in Chicago in 2014. Full disclosure,
I performed an onstage interview with Tower at the event. And that documentary became a reality. Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent, made its theatrical debut in 2017. A curious through line to all of this is that Tower seems almost as preoccupied with demanding his credit for Chez Panisse as he is with celebrating and memorializing stars. At the Roots of American Food Conference, Tower gives a talk. The first third to half are devoted to his telling of the Chez Panisse story. He runs down all the greatest hits, a story in which he nearly quit over the substandard quality of green beans delivered to the restaurant by a friend of the house purveyor, his odd couple relationship with Willie Bishop, the regional American dinner. One name is left conspicuously unspoken, as it was from a virtually identical speech he gave at MAD, René Redzepi's Copenhagen Think Conference earlier that year. Alice Waters. It reminds me of the time I broached the letter with Jeremiah. "I think it was okay to do it," he tells me. It's the only public evidence that she thought, up until that point. It was the only time she admitted to anybody that she thought I had done something valuable. And to this day, it doesn't horrify me that I did it. Not at all. Tower traces the depth of his resentment to the moment in 1982 when Waters scarcely credited his contribution to her first cookbook, which featured many of his recipes and menus. "This is the woman who took my name out," when she did the first book. But it swelled over the years to monster proportions. When I meet with Ruth Reichel for an interview on a rainy midweek afternoon at Back Bar Restaurant in Hudson, New York, she tells me the genesis of the documentary. Years prior, the 0.0 people had asked Reichel whom they should profile in the second season of Mind of a Chef. "And I said, Jeremiah," says Reichel. And Lydia Tanaglia, co-founder of 0.0 Productions, said, "Who's he? They'd never heard of him." That is the Alice Jeremiah problem right there. I mean, this is just maybe 5 years ago.
"Well, he's made a lot of headway," I say.
"Yep."
I share with Reichel that I've had a rough time sorting out the credit issue, and ask if Tower is wrong to feel as he does.
"You know? No. He's not wrong," says Reichel. "I mean, yes, he is wrong. I mean, actually, he was an important piece of Chez Panisse at that time, but Chez Panisse is Alice's creature. And you know, I mean, I think the thing is that is so interesting about that dynamic is just you're looking at two sides. You're sort of looking at Berkeley and San Francisco, you know? And Alice is a revolutionary, and her goal has always been to change the world through food. And Jeremiah is all about glamour and power and position. Alice, she drives a Prius. She lives in the same house she's always lived in."
A similar sentiment was offered by Boulevard Restaurant's Nancy Oaks.
"Alice changed what we eat. Jeremiah changed, in reality, how we eat."
In November 2014, Tower stunned the food world by taking the executive chef job at the embattled Tavern on the Green in New York City's Central Park, which had been taken over by two Philadelphia restaurateurs and had earned 0 stars from both the New York Times and New York Magazine. He actively pursued the job, even going through a fire drill at one point when the owners asked him to cook 5 dishes in 7 minutes. "And I did it, and it was fine," he says. "I ran around the stations. You know, I already knew what they were serving, but, you know, I sort of went to one of the sous chefs and said, 'Okay, what's great? What's in-house that I don't know about?' And he said, 'We have some filet for one of the banquets. You can have one of those.' And I saw some chanterelles, and I quickly made some Robuchon mashed potatoes and put a dish together with that. And then there were some heirloom tomatoes, so I chopped those up and made a wonderful sort of French-Mexican salsa out of that, put some tile fish in the pizza oven. There was some corn in there, so I cooked that with basil and olive oil, did a bed of that with the fish and the salsa on top, and a few other dishes like that." The familiar Tower pattern had been activated. He'd landed a shocking, attention-generating gig. But by April 2015, he was out of Tavern. Once again, he'd gone from low to high and back to low again.
It only took a year for the next recalibration. Before I knew it, it was April 2016, and I was sitting on a picture-perfect Saturday afternoon at the premiere of The Last Magnificent. In the audience are David Burke, Drew Naporant, former cooks and front-of-house staff from Starz. My world had also become bizarrely small. My publisher, Dan Halpern, seated mere feet from me, was set to publish a revised edition of California Dish, newly titled Start the Fire. On the screen, Towers' life plays out in reenactments, archival footage, and interviews. Mario Batali pronounces Starz more influential than Chez Panisse. We watch as 72-year-old Tower goes through the tavern folly. Notably absent from the film is Alice Waters, who didn't consent to an interview. The afternoon is a triumph for Tower, who's brought up on stage after the screening for a conversation with Tenaglia and Burdon, moderated by Charlie Rose, who wears sneakers with his dress pants. Tower is greeted by a standing ovation, peppered with people from throughout his life. It feels something like a Hollywood ending. In the ensuing months, the film shows at festivals around the United States. He travels to the events, teases them on Facebook. Oh, and in his spare time, he's written and released an etiquette book, Table Manners. The day before the premiere, my friend Chef Jimmy Bradley and I interview Tower, Bourdain, and Tenaglia for The Front Burner, a podcast we host on the web-based Heritage Radio Network. Afterwards, Jimmy and I rounded the corner to the elevators to find Tower standing there, trench coat draped over his arm. "Can we buy you a drink?" we asked. "Can't do it," he said. "Meeting people at Morea." Tower was, once again, in demand. And yet, just as Waters was missing from that speech in Chicago and the movie, she's also missing from the battle for Chez Panisse. As Tower travels around the world chasing his legacy, she relaxes in Berkeley, travels at her leisure with, whether right or wrong, nothing to prove. Another moment that haunts me from our interview. Did she really not remember that letter from her former collaborator and lover, framed on the wall in San Francisco's hottest restaurant for all to see? Or was she sending a sly signal that it doesn't matter? The letter may survive somewhere. For all I know, it hangs in Tower's kitchen in Cozumel. But there's no public wall on which to flaunt it. Whether this was all Jeremiah, or all Alice, or some of each, or neither, or whatever, is kind of beside the point, says Coleman Andrews, when I interviewed him, before launching into a description of Chez Panisse's relevance. What's funny is that I never asked him who deserved the credit. He was clearly anticipating, perhaps dreading, the question, weary of it. Professional cooking can be cruel. Not only does it demand that a chef prove his or her mettle every day, from scratch, but maintaining a place in the public consciousness demands a restaurant in which to do it. "I don't really see myself as a chef because I don't put on my whites," Tower said to me in our first interview. "I get to go out to dinner instead of cooking it. So no, I don't see myself as a chef so much anymore. I would be again the moment there was a restaurant and I put my whites on. But that's not my identity now for myself." This, it seems to me, is one of the key lessons of Tower's saga and explains his fixation, after all these years, on Chez Panisse, as well as his attempted comeback at Tavern on the Green. A chef without a restaurant is, almost by definition, incomplete, if not impossible. Those who were there will tell you that even by the early 1980s, Waters had attained the messianic glimmer that she exudes to this day. Even then, Chez Panisse was hailed in many circles as the first link in the new American restaurant's evolutionary chain. Maybe Tower sensed all along that his ocean liner was fated to go the way of most restaurants, while Chez Panisse, with a prominence poised to sustain its modest scale in perpetuity, was built for longevity. Starz menus are tucked away in the drawers of former cooks, its laughter faded, the dishes surviving only in the pages of Tower's cookbooks. And so I imagine Tower, looking out over generations who know nothing of Starz but make pilgrimages to Chez Panisse, and can understand why he still wants to claim it after all these years. because while his masterpiece's legacy endures, the place where he, in every sense of the word, left his mark, literally survives. As much a museum or a shrine as a restaurant. You could have dinner there tonight if you plan far enough ahead to have secured a reservation. That way lies immortality. 8. A Room of Their Own. Bobby wasn't Bobby. Mario wasn't Mario. We were all just cooks. Bruce Bromberg. How Blue Ribbon created the late-night chef culture of the 1990s, and the Food Network came out of nowhere to irreversibly alter the industry. Of all the unknowable aspects of professional kitchen life, perhaps none is more misunderstood by the general population than the late-night post-service rituals of cooks and chefs. Outside observers are as fascinated by the drinking and mating habits of the culinary set as they are by what happens in the pan or winds up on the plate. Cooks party hard. But for all the literal and virtual ink that's been devoted to their nocturnal exploits, to what happens after the whites are in the bin and street clothes have been donned, what most outsiders fail to grasp is that cooking doesn't just happen to attract people who like to drink to excess and go to sleep when vampires do. That it's not a coincidence that cooks party, but rather it's the work itself that necessitates it. Consider, for the average cook working a dinner shift, the day begins in the late morning and continues almost unbroken until well past midnight. The early hours may be calm, a time for prep work and banter. But as sunset approaches, the screws begin to turn and pressure builds toward the dinner hour. Once the orders start flying, heads turn downward and don't turn back up for 5 hours or longer. During that time, each cook will ready, fire, and plate a handful of dishes probably dozens of times. They will lose themselves in the tumult of service, acting on intuition. There will be periods of soulful, zen-like synchronicity. There will also be accidents, miscues, and recoveries. Tempers may flare along with the gas jets. Burns and bruises may accrue. Massive amounts of water and caffeine will be guzzled. Trips to the bathroom will be rare. After performing, cog-like, for hours, subordinating personality to the kitchen organism, the need for release is immense. And the easiest way to achieve it is, and always has been, through the consumption of alcohol. And so it's a phenomenon of the industry that those who cook develop a metabolic callus to massive alcohol intake, and to functioning on levels of sleep that would test a med student's stamina. We needed to decompress quickly because we had to come back the next day, so we would drink, says Paul Zwebin, a veteran of David Burke's River Cafe kitchen in the 1980s. The normal intake for a cook was anywhere from 6 to 12 beers a night. 12 beers, you were wasted. But 10 beers, you were fine. You were like, all right, guys, good night. I'm going home. Even now, I drink more than the normal person, says Zwebin, who co-owns a few Manhattan restaurants and has transitioned to a successful career in Manhattan real estate. If I went to the doctor and he asked me how many drinks I had a week, he'd say, you have a drinking problem. I remember there was one day I was bringing back recyclable bottles from my apartment, and I had like 15 cases of recyclable bottles, and my neighbor said, oh my God, did you have a party? I just looked at him and said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm just recycling my bottles. It was like we were on two different planets. There was always the drinking culture, says Tom Colicchio, who followed up his gigs at the Quilted Giraffe and Gotham Bar and Grill, by helming the kitchen at Mondrian in the late 1980s, where he became one of the few Americans of that decade to earn an elusive New York Times 3-star rating. But it's not surprising. It's a tough life in a way. It's always glorified, but it's fucking hard work. You're working holidays, you're working weekends, so your friends are the people you work with. It's very, very difficult to maintain relationships even with your buddies, because your friends are the friends who you're working with in the restaurant. And then the problem you have when you chef in that restaurant is that you can't be friends with these people anymore. It's much more of a screwed-up culture than people understand it to be. You start drinking when service ends. Last ticket goes out, you start drinking. You're cleaning up the kitchen, you're drinking. Then you'd go out and you'd drink some more. And you start doing drugs. It's nowhere near as glamorous as people think it is, the lifestyle. Daniel Boulou recalls that when he was running the kitchen at the Polo restaurant at the Westbury Hotel in the early 1980s, a trio of young American cooks would often work so late for him, helping prepare banquets and such, that he would put them up in a guest room. The problem was that I needed to deliver a case of beer to them. They were true American kids in this way. I never experienced that in France, the fact that they needed a case of beer before they could go to sleep. Says Stephen Colt, who cooked under Boulou at Le Cirque in the mid-1980s, Daniel runs a pressure cooker. He ramps it up and cranks it up and gets it as tight as it possibly can be. And so what are you going to do afterwards, go home and read a book? You're not going to go to sleep because you have adrenaline going and it doesn't stop. It winds down a little, but it's 11 p.m., and you just served 240 very high-end meals to everyone from Woody Allen to Richard Nixon to Jack and Jane from Connecticut. And he's already working on specials for the next day, and you're already thinking about when you've got to come in and what you have to do in the morning because you just used up all your stuff. It's not like today where people can't work more than 8 hours. This is a common lament among those who made their bones in the 1970s and 80s, that employment regulations and the specter of legal action create a climate where excessive working hours and the tough love of a chef, verbal or otherwise, can have devastating consequences. The exertions and pressures of life in a less evolved time created an even greater need for release than today's cooks feel. And in addition to the desire to decompress, read, drink, came a craving for human interaction, to commiserate with comrades after suppressing the stresses and frustrations of a shift. In the early days of the movement, the nocturnal scene was scattershot, lacking a focal point. Chefs and cooks tended to hang with their own crews at whatever bar was most convenient. In New York City, Charlie Palmer and his Ariol gang hit strip clubs or the Old Town, a 19th-century tavern on East 18th Street. Others closed down the Subway Inn, a dive bar around the corner from Bloomingdale's in Midtown, or whatever Irish bar was convenient. Boulou says that sometimes, by coincidence, cooks from different restaurants might end up at the same watering hole. Next to the subway station would be a bar, and all the cooks from every restaurant within a 10-block radius would meet there after work. Swevin remembers that there was a bar on Montague Street in Brooklyn Heights, where he and his fellow River Cafe cooks frequented, but he doesn't remember the name. Honestly, it didn't matter, he says. It was also in the light of day, which is just something that never happened. Much would change in chefs' social landscape in the early 1990s, connecting them with each other and with their growing fan base in unprecedented ways. The proliferation of charity events from coast to coast throughout the mid-1980s helped foster a national network by introducing chefs from different cities to each other. But as the 1990s dawned, the daily life of American chefs transformed as well, especially in New York City, where a community of cooks coalesced as never before. An early agent of change was Jerry Dawes, who hailed from southern Illinois, fell in love with wine, especially Spanish wines and culture, and had become a restaurant sales rep for the Weinbau Group. Because he sold to what he referred to as all-star chefs in New York City, Dawes began organizing industry parties to help promote his portfolio. Most of these were in New York City, but one memorable event was held in Spring Valley, New York, for which he hired a unicyclist as entertainment. There was just one problem. He was stoned and couldn't stay on the unicycle, drawls Dawes, whose accent sounds more southern than Illinois. Rather than spawn larger and larger parties, these events led Dawes to create a more intimate, periodic gathering of chefs who met once a month at each other's restaurants, where the host chef would prepare a 5-course lunch for the others. The inaugural group included future culinary deity Thomas Keller, still stuck in consulting mode. Le Cote Basque alum Rick Moonen, chefing by then for Buzzy O'Keefe at his waterside Manhattan restaurant, The Water Club, on the Manhattan side of the East River. Tom Valenti, chef for former Raquel manager Allison Price Becker at Allison on Dominick Street in Tribeca. Arizona 206's Brendan Walsh. Original Union Square Cafe chef Allie Barker. Chefs Phil McGrath and Matthew Tivy. Hudson River Club's Waldy Maloof, and Andy Fortzheimer, who had returned to the East Coast and was chef at Covadi.
It also included New York Mets veteran Rusty Staub, who owned two Manhattan restaurants at the time. The name of the group? Chefs from Hell. Dawes announced his intentions with an invitation, dated December 1989, that read as follows. Chefs from Hell. Acrobatic Unicyclists and Wine Tasters Club. Charter. Raison d'eat. And drink. I am forming a wine tasting club for chefs, because chefs are often neglected when it comes to getting enough wine to drink, that is, to taste. Since chefs ought to know what wines are good for their food, they should get more opportunities to taste wines in a relaxed atmosphere, where they can trade impressions with their fellow chefs, and shoot the breeze about wine with visiting winemakers, wine geeks, winery owners, etc. We will have special theme luncheons several times a year featuring guest winemakers, area specialists, and winery reps. We will not be conducting winner-slash-loser blind tastings. Our aim is to get a group of wines together and let the host chef create something to complement them so we can enjoy the wine, the food, and the camaraderie, and learn more about using wines to enhance food. Our wine luncheons will usually be held on the first or second Monday of each month. They will begin promptly at the appointed hour. Once or twice a year, we will have special tasting dinners. If you call to attend a luncheon, we expect you to show up or give us ample warning so that we can get a replacement. Only invitees and no substitutes or uninvited guests may attend. Except on special occasions, each luncheon will usually be limited to about 15 chefs, the guest wine hosts, and yours truly. So it is important that you reply early if you wish to attend. If you know an out-of-town chef who is visiting, please call and we will see if we can make a place for him. No restaurant critics will be allowed to attend except by prior approval of the group. We will, however, invite a prominent restaurant critic to join us once a year for the chef's roast for critics. If they don't show up, we will roast them anyway. Our arrangement with all restaurants hosting our monthly luncheons will be a $50 flat fee, tax and tip included, and no corkage. If we have not been able to arrange for the host winery to pay the tab for the group, and they usually will, please be prepared to pay $50 in cash. Except for special occasion luncheons or dinners, I really don't foresee the group having to pay for many of our regular functions. Please cough up an extra $10 apiece each time to sweeten the tip pool. The first lunch was held at Charlie Palmer's Ariole. The chefs showed up in the light of day in their street clothes. Moonin brought his knife kit along and was asked to check it at the door. Such a gathering is commonplace today, but at the time was uncharted territory. It was a little awkward at first, says Dawes. They really didn't know what to expect. But after a couple glasses of wine, things started to loosen up, and they were cool with it. There was no problem getting them for the second one, and they started recommending other guys to bring in. Not all chefs were on board from the get-go. Dawes says that Terence Brennan, though he eventually joined, commented that it was an unserious forum and wasn't interested. With his tongue firmly in cheek, Dawes created a series of bylaws that was expanded periodically, eventually swelling to 59 items. Among them were asterisks indicate rules that were broken, with multiple asterisks indicating multiple infractions. 1. Absolutely no acrobatic unicyclists allowed. 5. Meat cleavers and other cutlery are to be checked at the door. 1 asterisk. 6. If a chef cannot attend, it is not permissible to send dead monkfish or any other fish or animal, alive or dead, to sit in his seat as a proxy. 1 asterisk. 7. There will be no overt criticism of the host chef's food while he is in earshot, and while we will allow spitting out of wines, we will not tolerate spitting out the host chef's food. 6 asterisks. 10. The word slut, regardless of which sex it refers to, is forbidden at our gatherings. 5 asterisks. 11. Urinating on the shrubbery or fire hydrant outside the host restaurant in daylight is strictly forbidden. 1 asterisk. 15. This rule should be obvious to anyone in this group with class. We really discourage moonshots during service. It draws attention away from the host chef's food
and it is just not the image we want to project. 22. We really want to discourage these chefs' war stories about sex in a walk-in. Some of our members haven't had any anywhere in so long that this kind of talk just makes them jealous. 10 asterisks. 23. We were successful in getting some women to attend Chefs from Hell functions. After Rusty Staub's Mardi Gras luncheon, we think it prudent to advise members that we will not tolerate shouts of "show your tits" or any other such sexist remarks by either sex, even at Mardi Gras luncheons. 1 asterisk. 25. All meals will be limited to 5 courses, if courses are full portions. 7, if they are tasting portions. Addendum to rule number 25. Furthermore, combinations of caviar, truffles, and foie gras are limited to 3 maximum on any one plate. Any chef who breaks this rule should be advised that the penalty is severe. We will send a copy of the menu to the owner of your restaurant, reminding him/her of the $50 per head rule, and thanking him for his charitable donation to the Chefs from Hell. 9 asterisks. 26. We would like to discourage the past Chefs from Hell trend toward wretched excess in the dessert category. Therefore, the official position on desserts from here on will be as follows. We will frown on creations that move, smoke, or require batteries, and we will be especially critical of those configured to pick up radio broadcasts. We really don't want to eat something from FAO Schwartz. 6 asterisks. 27. God, why do we even have to consider this one a rule? To any civilized person, it would seem obvious that one does not discuss surgical scars, let alone show them during the course of the meal. It also would seem to go without saying that detailed discussions of the fine art of circumcision would fall in this category. 1 asterisk. 28. The Pittsburgh Pirates hat procurement rule has been deleted. They are no longer the official baseball team of CFH. They threaten to sue for defamation. 43. For future outings, where cars are required, we will appoint a designated driver for Colicchio, whether he has had anything to drink or not. 53. It should go without saying that the unwritten rule amongst gentlemen chefs, an oxymoron if there ever was one, about not breaking wind at these functions is still a rule, written or not. We have a good idea who has been doing this, so just remember, if you are caught, you risk a 1-function suspension, enforced by the sergeant at arms, if and when we ever find him again. 1 asterisk. 56. We are tired of these feeble excuses for missing Chefs from Hell functions. Among some of the more notorious and overused ones are: 1. I got married. 2. I had to play in a charity golf tournament. 3. I can't stand my husband's, the host chef's, food. 4. I got locked in a walk-in. 5. I am sunning my ass in Mexico. And worst of all, 6. I had to work. From now on, the only valid excuses for not attending a CFH function are: A. I was hungover. B. I caught a social disease for which I was not the primary distributor. C. My restaurant went Chapter 11, and I was held at gunpoint by an irate supplier. D. The host chef is my former sous chef, sorry, chef de cuisine, and I taught him everything he knows. 57. It also goes without saying that rules number 11 and number 47 prohibiting urinating on fire hydrants, shrubs, etc., also includes the pig fountain at the James Beard House. 2 asterisks. And the unspoken first rule is, we'll break every damn rule in this rule book, which really appeals to chefs, because they're rule breakers, says Dawes. It doesn't sound like the kind of association with which the pathologically serious Thomas Keller would associate himself, but he says he believed in the cause. It's camaraderie. It's the one thing that we don't really do enough at any time throughout our careers. I think one of the things that inspired me to become a chef, or continues to inspire me to become a chef, was the book The Great Chefs of France. You look at that book and you look at those guys and they were all comrades. They were colleagues. They were friends. They did things together outside the restaurant. and we didn't have that in this country. We were skeptical. We were apprehensive. We were threatened by other chefs. So the idea of bringing chefs together is an extraordinary thing. When Jerry did that, it was like, wow, this is pretty cool. I get to meet these other guys. We get to spend time together. We get to do things together outside the restaurants. I think that was a very important thing. Prior to Chefs from Hell, says Keller, New York chefs were too busy to connect. As a community of professionals, we are one of the few that actually doesn't spend time together. If you're an attorney, there are always these guilds. There are always these symposiums. It's not about press. That's where we got off track. Today, we do things together only if there's a press angle to it. Only if there's some value for somebody to write about. Because it gives us more recognition and feeds our ego. Doctors, attorneys, they don't do their meetings to be written about. They do it to exchange ideas, because they enjoy one another. Chefs from Hell was kind of like that. There was no media angle. Jerry brought it together just for the benefit of us, to have fun. We'd go out with Rusty Staub. I mean, Christ. He'd take us to opening day at Shea Stadium. Who gets to do that with Rusty Staub? Rusty is still a friend today. Tom Colicchio remembers it less loftily than Keller, to whom he was a sous chef at Raquel in the late 1980s. We would literally sit around and drink and laugh our asses off. A lot of these guys have their chef personality. When you get together in a room with them, they're funny as hell. I remember sitting next to Tom Valenti and just fucking laughing so much that wine's pouring out of our noses. We had a good time. And some of it was poking fun. If someone bombed a dish, we'd all fucking get on him. You never gave the person the business, but you'd comment to each other. Like Tom Valenti would say, "You'd eat this? This sucks." It was also in the light of day, which is just something that never happened. We'd always get together in bars. The organization wasn't an organization. It was literally, who's cooking this month and where are we going? And that was it. But if you were the chef cooking, you were showing off because these were all your peers. So to me, it was a great time because when do you get to hang out with the guys who you work with? I work with Tom Valenti at Gotham, and so he's cooking at Allison on Dominic, and I'm doing what I'm doing. You don't see him. So all of a sudden you have this luncheon and you're with all these guys that you know and you like, and you all came up at the same time. It was a blast. Charter member Rick Moonen says that prior to Chefs from Hell, there was scant cross-pollination among cooks from different kitchens. Although, as more and more young Americans entered the profession and advanced from job to job, a network was being established. But Chefs from Hell accelerated that process by a large margin, he says. Dawes freely admits that he had several motivations for starting Chefs from Hell. One was to sell his wines to the chefs. Another was that he was tired of hanging out with cork dorks, preferring the company of cooks. I saw chefs as kind of blue-collar guys in those days that knew how to have fun. They got off late. They went out and raised hell. It was quickly established that the host chef was going to show off for his peers. At River Cafe, David Burke, in accordance with his signature River Cafe chocolate bridge, made the centerpiece of his dessert presentation a chocolate stove that actually smoked. And Rick Moonen fashioned a ship sailing across a coconut raspberry sea to a cookie island. Burke also served a tuna tartare, covered with crème fraîche and smothered with Ocetra caviar. If Buzzy had caught him, he'd have probably kicked his ass, laughs Dawes. Rick Moonen says that getting to know his peers excited me, inspired me to do better. The lunches, he says, became an outlet for healthy competition, such as the one served by Tom Valenti at Allison on Dominic Street. I remember having a cylinder, like a filet mignon, of swordfish. It was served medium rare and wrapped in bacon or some sort of a pork product. I remember it as if it was yesterday. As in any boys' club, there were the inevitable pranks. Dawes created a Chefs from Hell barf bag by having his daughter draw a design on an airline bag. At an Allison on Dominic Street lunch, the chefs summoned Tom Valenti from the kitchen to inform him that his food had made Rick Moonen sick. When Valenti emerged, they pointed to an ashen Moonen holding the bag. It helped that Moonen was actually queasy that day, so he looked the part. Dawes, who had surreptitiously loaded the bag with vegetable soup, asked for it. He gives it to me, and I opened it up and said, "Hey, man, this looks better than the shit coming out of the kitchen." I get in with a spoon and take a bite. I thought Valenti was going to have a hemorrhage. Another gag occurred at the water club. Recounts Dawes, "Buzzy O'Keefe always did things right. He had this tuxedoed waiter running the show. He has an upstairs dining room. Moonen had the whole place full downstairs for lunch. And he was feeding us, and we had Bob Haas burgundies. They had these beautiful floral arrangements on the table. That's where I got the rule about you can't eat the floral arrangements because they cost more than the entrees. And he shows me that he's brought this big plastic beetle. So there's a salad course, and I pick a little bit of the salad, and I stick the bug in it, and I call the guy over. I said, "Would you please take this down to the chef and tell him that he really should take more care in washing and cleaning his greens?" So Moonen's down there getting slammed, and apparently the guy brings it to him. He says, "What the fuck? Who sent this down here?" The waiter says, "The guy who's running the luncheon." Nothing was said. The guy didn't come back and say, "Moonen tells you go fuck yourself," or anything like that. But come dessert time on my plate, one of the chocolates is this plastic beetle covered in chocolate. On the more serious side, after a few lunches, Dawes instituted show and tell, asking each chef to stand up and update us on what they were doing, if they'd changed restaurants. Tell us how things were going for them, all this kind of stuff. So they all basically got up and did that. In the 1990s, the group would expand and contract, counting among its members such chefs and industry figures as Odeon chef Stephen Lyle, D'Artagnan co-founder George Faison, Union Square Cafe's Michael Romano, Tribeca Grill's Don Pintabona, 21 Club's Michael Lomonaco, Tom Colicchio, Mario Batali, who moved to New York from San Francisco, Bobby Flay, who had found his Southwestern voice first at Miracle Grill, and then at Mesa Grill, in partnership with Gotham impresario Jerry Kretschmer and partners, and James Beard Foundation president Len Pickle. Notably absent were Jonathan Waxman and Larry Forgione, which Dawes says was due to the fact that they were traveling in their own rarefied air, part of the more nationally known clique of celebrity chefs of the day. Though largely a boys' club, women did join the pack, including Arcadia's Anne Rosenzweig, Rose Levy Barenbaum, Teresa Baronaccia, Pamela Morgan, and honorary member Julia Child. Dawes invited Martha Stewart to join a lunch at Gramercy Tavern when Tom Colicchio was at the helm. Remembers Dawes of that day's show and tell. When Martha's turn comes up, she gets up and tells a story that has fuck in it because she wanted to show that she's one of the guys. It was about some guy who had gotten pissed off and quit and had sent out a Christmas card with, "And I hope you have a fucking good Christmas," or something like that, printed on it. And they had to call all these people who'd received these cards and tell them it was some disgruntled employee who had sent it. So she got to work her fuck in to show that she's one of the boys. Later on, she had us all up to her place in Connecticut. Chefs from Hell charter member Rick Moonen also belonged to an intimate, less well-remembered group, the Red Meat Club, that started up around the same time. Never mind that at both the Water Club and then at Oceana, he was known as one of New York's premier fish chefs. The club, also centered around lunches, included sommeliers Tracy Dutton and John Fisher, legendary bartender Dale DeGroff, and chef David Page. Red Meat Club met the second Tuesday of every month. "Different steakhouse," says Moonen. "You were only allowed to order two types of cocktails, a beef-eater martini or a Bloody Mary. Why? Because those are the rules. Because we're a fucking red meat society, and we eat red meat, and we mean it. If you ordered it rare, you had to follow it with, 'And I mean rare.' Those are the rules. I'll have the ribeye steak rare, and I mean rare." And everybody would go, "And I mean rare." We'd sit around and we'd get drunk on the second Tuesday of every month. At Palm 2, Ben Benson's. This was real, says Moonen. This wasn't some phantom 12-month thing. This was the Red Meat Club, man. There was the Chefs from Hell and the Red Meat Club. Not to be taken lightly. You can only do that so long.
In 1990, Moonen partnered with two fellow Lakote Bosque alums, Charlie Palmer and Frank Crispo, then the chef at Andiamo, to take the emerging society of New York City chefs to the next level, to combine the desire for community with their universal late-night habits at a restaurant called Chef's Cuisiners Club. The idea was hatched, remembers Crispo, on Super Bowl Sunday that January. We were all looking to go out, and there was really nothing to do. We found ourselves at Rusty Staub's eating frozen Weaver drumsticks, or whatever they used to serve there. And we started saying, hey, let's open up a place just for cooks, for where we can hang out. I had a friend that knew this Mexican restaurant on 22nd Street that wanted to get out of business. We put the finances together, and I did the plumbing and all the stoves, and Charlie's sister, who had worked for Adam Tierney, did the design. The ability to jump in underscored the differences between chefs who owned their own restaurants, even in partnership with others, and those who didn't. Palmer didn't need to ask anybody's permission, but for Moonen, working for Buzzy O'Keefe at the Water Club, things were more complicated. I had to ask permission from Buzzy to be a partner in it. He wasn't too keen on it. The concept was greeted enthusiastically by the media, a logical next step in the growing fascination with the American chef community. The only potential problem, mused the New York Times' Brian Miller, is when hip New York night owls sniff it out, will there be any room for chefs? Situated in a narrow rectangular space on East 22nd Street, with a long bar that gave way to an intimate dining room, the Chef's Cuisiners Club, or the Triple C as the owners came to refer to it, opened in early fall 1990. On the walls were framed menus from the owner's heroes such as George Blanc, Paul Bocuse, and Elaine Chapelle, and a bulletin board advertising kitchen employment opportunities. There was also a library of cookbooks and food magazines, and in 1992, Palmer commissioned a 9 by 4.5 foot mural, a Last Supper-ish representation of legends such as Bocuse, Blanc, Chapelle, Marie-Antoine Karim, Auguste Escoffier, Alain Ducasse, and contemporaries Wolfgang Puck and Le Cirque impresario Cirio Maccioni. Early menu items, turned out by chef Peter Assou, a Palmer protege, included warm goat cheese over warm potato salad and a tomato shallot vinaigrette, eggplant and lentil terrine, and braised cod in a broth with oven-dried tomatoes. But the menu changed often, and not always based on Assou's inspiration. He's got three guys telling him what to do, says Palmer. And then we'd all go down there and do shit on our own. It was kind of like, what do you feel like eating late at night this week? I mean, literally, we changed the menu that Monday night at the bar, at 2 in the morning. The trio of chef owners leveraged their industry clientele to secure great deals and giveaways from vendors. For example, the food was served on a hodgepodge of plates from luxury producers like Wedgwood and Villeroy and Bach, who gifted them to the restaurant for exposure. The idea was we'd get plates from every manufacturer, so there would be a mix and match on the tables. So if you liked a plate, you'd turn it over and say, who is this by? So we'd haggle a little bit and get it for free. Because of all the cigar smoking, we got Partagas to do a party, says Crispo. There were Halloween parties, Crispo dressed as Aunt Jemima, Oktoberfest bashes, Christmas and New Year's Eve bacchanals. We never made any money, because every time we made some money, we'd throw a party, says Palmer. These were epic parties, I mean, epic. Spilled into the street. People complained about the noise. Police came every time. There were also gag events, like a lamprey eel-eating contest to be judged by Montrachet owner Drew Naporant, who opened Tribeca Grill in partnership with Robert De Niro the same year Chef's Cuisiners Club launched. That was promoted with a flyer circulated to restaurants by fetching young females from the Triple C's front-of-house team. The flyer was real. The event was pure fiction. The emerging community of star chefs flocked to the restaurant. David Burke, Larry Forgione, Tom Colicchio, Jean-Georges Vongerichten, Daniel Boulou, and chef couple Bobby Flay and Deborah Ponczik, who would go on to marry and divorce. Like chefs from hell, early on, Chef's Cuisiners Club seemed like a boys' club, all the more so for the cigar smoke that filled the air late in the evening from, among others, Palmer himself,
although as Palmer says, we got the chefs, but also got the chicks that like chefs. It was exactly what we hoped it would be. There was one downside to an industry clientele. We had a ton of house accounts because nobody ever paid for shit, says Palmer. Chefs would be like, what are you going to say? No? That's what we did the place for. There's a lot of deadbeat chefs, you know? The critical reception was mixed. New York Magazine's Gail Green was swept up in the scene. On the whole, enjoyed the food. The New York Times' Marion Burroughs, in a one-star takedown, complained that providing moderately priced food is not a license to hire an untrained staff and inflict them on paying customers. She also hypothesized that perhaps when Mr. Palmer and his chef friends arrive after midnight, they are too tired to notice the lapses. Perhaps they get better treatment and more carefully prepared food than the average customer. The Times review still rankles at least one partner. It was weird, says Crispo. She was digging at him for no reason. They singled out Charlie because he had Auréole. Beyond the job listings, Hervé Rieu, a Frenchman who moved to New York City in 1988 and ran the kitchen at the Plaza Hotel's Edwardian Room, remembers another function of the Chef's Cuisiners Club, to find new hires on the spot. If you needed a job, you could go there, speak to a chef, do a line of coke, order a burger, and if you were lucky, you would stay until closing and go to work with him that very morning, says Rieu. Chef's Cuisiners Club also began publishing a newsletter, something the Red Meat Club, Blue, and Danny Meyer were also doing, deepening a connection with customers, even as chefs were forging improved relationships with each other. In addition to its newsletter, the Triple C also hosted tastings of everything from Spanish olive oil to Chablis and oysters to a roster of 27 chocolates one summer afternoon. There were also wine dinners at which menus were built around a particular vineyard's offerings. What started well faded quickly. Chef's Cuisiners Club lost its mojo and its chef clientele. It started out just being a hangout, says Crispo, but the egos of the chefs involved possibly made the place more of a restaurant. As the best chefs in town made it their after-hours destination, the owners felt they had to step up the food. Next thing you know, instead of just doing funky stuff like tripe, we found ourselves having a traditional menu, appetizers, main course, and Richie Leach, Charlie's pastry chef, would do pastries. Palmer cites another reason for the Triple C slowing to a halt. I had to stop the party. I was dying. Frank and Rick and I, we were there till like 2-3 in the morning every freaking night practically. You can only do that so long. The chefs decided to go their separate ways, divvying up what little profit remained, with Palmer holding on to the lease. In the fall of 1994, Palmer partnered with Fernando Saraligi, a veteran of Café Luxembourg and Raoul's, to recast the space as Alva, after Thomas Alva Edison, a cigar bar and restaurant. When the New York Times asked Saraligi where the chefs would congregate after the Triple C served its last supper, he replied, Blue Ribbon, where they already have been hanging out for the past 2 years.
You know, I hate this wall.
The desire for community, a place to eat and drink and connect after hours, was finally fulfilled, once and for all and against all odds, by a Sullivan Street restaurant that was a debacle in its first incarnation. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote that, great art is the contempt of a great man for small art. Well, Blue Ribbon largely grew from two brothers' contempt for their own small art, a failed restaurant launched in June 1992, with a name made for calamity, the Crystal Room. The Crystal Room was launched by siblings Bruce and Eric Bromberg and partner Philip Hoffman. The Bromberg brothers had been raised across the Hudson River in New Jersey in a food-crazed Jewish-American family. Their father, an attorney, bon vivant and adventurous home cook, exposed them to every imaginable food, and their grandmother was, by the brothers' estimation, one of the best cooks in her tight-knit conservative Jewish community. The brothers grew up loving food, with a special fascination for the theatrical, like the Japanese steakhouse chain Benihana, where the cooks performed miraculous knife work in harrowingly close proximity to diners. They were also raised to be Francophiles. Dad had a house in Venasque, near Avignon in Provence, where a local chef would let the boys visit the kitchen, pour cognac over his shrimp Provençal to flame it. We thought it was the coolest shit, remembers Bruce. Born 5 years apart, both brothers attended Le Cordon Bleu cooking school in Paris. On his return to the States, after working for Jonathan Waxman at Jams, Eric honchoed other kitchens before opening, in 1989, Nick and Eddie, a popular Soho restaurant fashioned after the timeless aesthetic of New York watering holes, all dark wood and mirrors, with a bar in the front room, that served stripped-down food such as a spinach and bacon salad, roast chicken, and an uncommonly sophisticated burger, counter-programming to the increasingly complicated plates being turned out by other young Americans around town. Nick and Eddie was an early bastion of what Eric considers New York food and would come to be known as comfort food. The restaurant also broke with another given in hotspots of the day, with a no-reservation policy designed to keep the place accessible to neighborhood diners. When an appealing space opened nearby on Sullivan Street, Nick and Eddie partner, Philip Hoffman, nabbed it and put together a partnership with Eric, who summoned Bruce to return from France and collaborate with him. The brothers' enthusiasm waned as the Crystal Room evolved, under Hoffman's direction, into the very antithesis of Nick and Eddie. As brilliant as Nick and Eddie was, the Crystal Room was as non-brilliant, says Bruce. It was like an exclusive social club. It was just all wrong. Because of its connection to white-hot Nick and Eddie, reservations at the Crystal Room were hard to come by early on, although first-time visitors were aghast at the restaurant's design. It was horrible, says Bruce. There was a Grecian scene painted on the walls and Byzantine columns. The room was dimly lit, but not dim enough. According to Bruce, within 4 weeks, Hoffman stopped showing up. He saw the writing on the wall. He knew this was a major disaster. Eric had sunk everything he had into the restaurant, plus money from their father and family friends. Within 10 weeks, the Crystal Room had been left for dead by the citizenry. All of a sudden, it was me and my brother and our core team sitting there, and we basically realized we were going out of business, says Bruce. One midnight after service, Eric emerged from the kitchen. Guys, we're done, he said. We're not going to open tomorrow. I've pretty much lost my shirt. I can't continue to lose any more of my family's money. I can't take purveyors' food and not pay them for it, which is what we're doing. The crew, including runner Sean Sonamore, cook Chris Pollock, and waiter David Brown, some of whom came with Eric from Nick and Eddie, and others of whom who were new to the team, soaked up the news. Then Sonamore stood up, sauntered over to the wall that separated the lounge from the dining room, and said, "You know, I hate this wall," and put his foot right through it. About an hour and a half later, that wall was completely gone, remembers Bruce. Eric was just sitting there with his bottle of scotch in the corner, drowning his sorrows, and we were like, "Dude, we can rebuild this. We can make good food. It's a good location. Let's do it." The next day we called my dad and asked him for $25,000. With no real plan, the team began remaking the dining room. People would come by and ask, "What kind of food are you making?" We'd say, "Good food." We didn't have an idea. Up until a couple days before we opened, we hadn't written a menu. We didn't know what it was. Before the menu came the name, for which they were desperate. Their father, based on the Sullivan Street location, suggested Gilbert's on Sullivan, even though there was no Gilbert involved. Thankfully, the brothers resisted. Late one night, hanging out in the space, drinking beers with Nick and Eddie bartender George Gilmore, the brothers began bandying about names. "What's this place mean to you?" asked Gilmore. "What do you want it to be?" "I want it to not be French, but somehow I want everything we've learned and everything we're about to come through," said Bruce. "What's the name of that school you guys went to?" asked Gilmore. "Le Cordon Bleu." "What's that translated into English?" "Blue ribbon," says Bruce. And he said, "Well, then you're done." Recalls Bruce, and Eric and I looked at him and said, "You are right. We are done." A few nights later, with the space still months from completion, The brothers hosted a party. We were playing roller hockey in the dining room. We all had rollerblades and we had a goal set up on either side of the restaurant. And we were all drunk, skating around, having a ball, says Bruce.